It's the Scotty Myers Show.
Hey there. Welcome to this week's edition of the show. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget to check out all our social media channels, The Scotty Myers Show on Facebook and Instagram, at Scotty Myers on Twitter, and The Scotty Myers Show on YouTube. Now, if you are already on our YouTube channel, you may have caught my In the Car right after I got out of the theater, immediate thoughts on The Batman. And we'll talk a bit more about it later on. I'm going to try to keep it spoiler-free, but I'll warn you before I get into it that the odd one might slip. I just can't help it. The movie is really good. There's the spoiler. It's really good. We'll talk more in depth about it later on. Last time we chatted, I mentioned that I might travel again. Looks like it's happening. Looks like I'm going to Florida, back to Disney, ride some roller coasters. So you may want to check our YouTube channel there as well, because I'll have some videos going up from the trip, which I'm very much looking forward to. Let's get into the geek news. It's not super heavy this week, just a few things to touch on, and then we're going to get into the Batman. So we'll start in the Marvel world. Kevin Feige was doing a little chat, and someone asked him who the anchor of the Marvel Cinematic Universe was, and you may expect him to say Spider-Man at this point, but he shockingly said Doctor Strange is the anchor of the MCU right now. And a pretty drastic shift if you think about where the MCU was a couple of years ago, when you had obviously Iron Man was your anchor point of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and you know, Captain America maybe a close second, and now that has shifted to Doctor Strange. Interesting, in my mind. Very, very interesting take from Feige, especially since Strange is not, I don't want to say he's not a popular character, because he obviously is, but he's not a very stable character. You know, things can go very awry in the world of magic, so it seems like an odd choice to call your anchor, but we shall see how that works out for them. I think it might be out of necessity, in all honesty. The critically loved and fan-adored Netflix Marvel series, the kind of Defenders line, is now officially on Disney+. Fans are freaking out that now all their Marvel stuff is under one roof. There are parental controls on Disney+, though, so that the little ones don't get into Marvel content that maybe they shouldn't. You know, I'm not sure if they're going to throw those parental controls on Moon Knight. I mean, my experience with Moon Knight in the comics is that you probably should, but we'll see what this iteration does. Jessica Jones, the lead actress, Christian Ritter, she fueled some speculation online that she might be coming back with some tweets that kind of hinted that she could be headed back to the role. We shall see how much Marvel and Disney want to mine the Defenders. We know they're taking Daredevil. Charlie Cox is Daredevil. We know they're taking that. But, you know, are they going to grab Luke Cage? Are they going to grab Jessica Jones and pull them fully into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Only time will tell. I think it's probably in their best interest to do so. It's just, if you're going to pull them into the MCU, you almost have to reintroduce them in a way. Because probably a lot of the Marvel, younger Marvel fan base probably didn't see those shows, and so may not know these characters as well as maybe they should. So it's a gamble, but I think it would pay off. Over at Sony, their Spider-Verse continues to grow. The Kraven movie is picking up a lot of steam. Finally, we're going to see Kraven the Hunter on the big screen. Aaron Taylor-Johnson playing the lead role. We knew Russell Crowe was added, who to me just flat out looks like Kraven the Hunter anyway. Nothing against Aaron Taylor-Johnson, but like, if you got Russell Crowe, maybe he's Kraven. He's actually going to be their dad, Nikolai Kravenoff. That's the role he'll be playing. Ariana DeBose, who was in West Side Story, she has been cast as Calypso, a Spider-Man villain, also a lover of Kraven, so I don't know if we're going to get a Kraven sex scene, but with her in the film, it's possible. And they have also cast Alessandro Nivola, who was in The Many Saints of Newark, very good in that. His role has not been revealed. I'm thinking he's going to be the Chameleon, which would be the villain of the film. It's Kraven's brother, so you'd have brother against brother, and it did say that he has been cast as the film's villain. So to me, that would make the most sense. We'll see if that's how it all pans out, but that would be my guess. I'm excited to see a Kraven movie. I'm just not sure how he's going to work as a lead character. I've always dug the character in comics, but just wrapping my head around it with him as the lead. We'll have to see how this goes. Sony's doing interesting stuff. Whether it all works or not is the question. But taking kind of these villain characters and giving them their own films where at some point you have to make them, you have to root for somebody in a movie, right? So if you go watch this film, I'll use Kraven as an example. You go watch the Kraven movie and so he's not the villain. So you're rooting for Kraven. Then he's going to show up in a Spider-Man movie where he is the villain. So it's a guy that you've already kind of become attached to, but now you're going to have to root against. I'm just going to be curious to see how this all pans out. It's a different world-building strategy. See if it works. Over to Star Wars, where we got that look at the Star Wars Eclipse game. Remember how badass that looked? Well, relax. It's not coming for quite some time. Reports indicate that that Star Wars Eclipse game will not release until 2027 or later. They're not even committing to 5 years from now. They're going, listen, 2027, we're going to do our best. But, it's the Guns N' Roses Chinese democracy of Star Wars games. And I just sit there and I go, why announce the fucking thing? Like, honestly, if you don't have a firm release date for a game, why announce it so early? It just could end up backfiring in your face, because what if this game never happens, right? When they showed that trailer at the Game Awards, people went nuts because it looked really cool and really different. And the fact that we're going to have to wait 5, 6, who knows how long to get it, just keep it under your bonnet for a little while. There's nothing worse than when projects get announced and they don't happen. And I'll use the case of Justice League Dark is one of my more recent ones. You know, oh, Warner Brothers, we're gonna make Justice League Dark and we got Guillermo del Toro. Take all my fucking money for that project. And then what happens? It doesn't happen. Very disappointing. So I just don't think they should have announced that game yet. Speaking of delays, Bad Batch Season 2, it could be delayed. This latest edition of the Star Wars Insider listed a bunch of things coming for 2022 and did not list Bad Batch Season 2. Could have been an oversight. Still could happen. There's no definitive word. But definitely seems like a delay is in line for the second season of The Bad Batch, which the first season was fantastic, so I'm really, really looking forward to that. Speaking of something that isn't delayed in the Star Wars universe, Rogue Squadron, the Patty Jenkins Star Wars film, it is still listed as a 2023 release, despite both parties coming out and saying that they were having creative differences. So I don't know if maybe quietly Patty Jenkins has been removed from the project, and, you know, Disney, Lucasfilm are just boring ahead with someone else, or maybe those creative differences were ironed out really quickly and things are still on track. But it's March 2022. We have heard nothing on shooting, nothing on casting. We haven't heard a boo about this movie since we heard that there was creative differences. So I think it's still listed. I don't think it's happening. There's no way that movie comes out in 2023 without it being an absolute rush job. And usually rush jobs don't work out. I know there are cases where they do. Can't think of any off the top of my head, but I'm sure it's happened. But man, you want to give me a grandiose Star Wars dogfighting in space epic film and shoot it and have it out in a year and a half? I'm not going to have a lot of faith in that. I'm really just not. So we'll see what happens there, but I wouldn't count on seeing Rogue Squadron next year. And the biggest thing that happened in the Star Wars world over the last little bit since we last talked is the Star Wars Galactic Cruiser at Disney World has officially opened. Now, I know at the beginning of the show I said I'm going to Disney World. I am not going on the Galactic Cruiser as much as I want to. I just don't have that much money. And despite my best efforts, Disney did not reach out and offer me a spot. Having said that, I am still willing to do it at any time Disney would like, you know, a little bit more press on the Galactic Cruiser. Sad part is, I don't think they're going to need it. There was all this negative talk before Galactic Cruiser launched, right? That it looked cheesy, that it looked hokey, it wasn't going to live up to the expectations. All this negative stuff was hitting the internet. People were canceling reservations. It just seemed like a giant catastrophe. Well, now the first batch of reviews are out for Galactic Cruiser, and I will say that I have not really seen any super negative reviews. Most have been very positive. People saying they had a great time on the Galactic Cruiser. Yeah, they, you know, a few things here and there that they would like to have seen done differently or maybe done a little bit better. But overall, people are digging the experience. One review I listened to on a YouTube channel, Disney Food Blog, they do good stuff. They compared it to a like a murder mystery kind of escape room all rolled into one in the Star Wars universe, which sounds really cool. And depending on what role you have will determine kind of your flight and what your flight is like. So it's almost like a choose your own adventure in that way as well. So it's based on some of the reviews I've read, it's almost the type of experience that you could go do it. And then if you went and did it again and made different choices or aligned yourself in a different way, the experience would be almost completely different, which is amazing replay value. Like if we're thinking of this as a game, because you are going to basically role play for a couple of days in the Star Wars universe. If we think of it as a game, there's massive replayability, if that is the case, that the experience is that different. Now, not everybody is going to have the money to play once, because it is really expensive, let alone play multiple times. But the fact that it seems like it's built for that replayability is super smart on Disney's part. I got to give them credit there, because then you get the diehards, which if I had the money, I would be. That would be going to this thing. It might become a yearly thing. It might become every couple of years where it's like, you know what? I saved up my pennies and well, maybe nickels to get enough money for that. Maybe quarters even. But still, I saved up my change and I'm going to do the Galactic Cruiser again. And I'm sure they will modify it in the years to come, right? Give that thing 2 or 3 years. There'll probably be an entirely different story. And some reviews have even said it makes going to Galaxy's Edge that much better when you're in character and in the role and living in that universe, that Galaxy's Edge kind of feels like a more complete experience than when you just visit it on its own, which I love just visiting Batuu, the planet that Galaxy's Edge takes place on its own. I mean, that first morning I was there, it's one of my most vivid memories. First morning I was there, opening day for Galaxy's Edge, and the first time I saw the Falcon, I damn near cried. So the fact that it enhances that to me is crazy as well. So it seemed like what was going to be a big miss for Disney has turned into, I don't want to say a big hit, because we'll have to see how sustainable the ride. We'll have to see how sustainable the ride is and how sustainable the price point is for people. But if it's sustainable, if people are willing to pay that and go live a Star Wars fantasy for a couple of days, based on the early reviews, this could be a big hit for Disney, which is insane because it looked like this was going to be a massive, massive failure just a month ago, the way everybody was talking online. So how quickly things can change. And damn, I'm jealous of everybody that's gotten to do it so far. Very, very jealous. Let's switch over to DC. And before I get into the Batman, there's just a couple other little things I want to hit on in the DC universe. Joe Manganiello, he has sparked talk that he's coming back to be Deathstroke in the DCEU. He posted an Instagram photo that kind of featured his Nightmare Deathstroke haircut, the mohawk look, and that has led to speculation that he is coming back. Not only coming back there, that the Snyderverse is coming back. I still don't see that happening. I would love him to return as Deathstroke, though. I think that would be a great, he was great in the role, so I think it'd be a great thing if he came back. again, I'm not super into the nightmare world thing. I don't want to see that world explored anymore. But if he wants to come back and be Deathstroke to take on, you know, I don't know, Nightwing or the Titans or Batgirl, any, you know, Batman, whoever it's going to be, whether it's, you know, Affleck, if he's still alive after the Flash, which depending on what you read, Keaton, it doesn't matter. I just want some more Deathstroke in the DCEU. So that is very cool. Speaking of Batgirl, we did get some better set photos that show off Firefly's costume. Brendan Fraser, of course, playing Firefly. And it looks good. It looks like authentic, I guess is the best way I want to say it. It's not comic accurate for some of the portrayals, but it feels like this is what, if you were an arsonist. That's it. If you were a pyromaniac arsonist and you made a home costume, this is kind of what it looks like. So the Batgirl seems to be very street level, right? Because Batgirl, obviously her costume that we've seen so far, homemade. And then Firefly's costume, again, looks a little homemade. But if all this guy is just, you know, an arsonist and a pyromaniac, he's not backed by big money. So he's just going to have to make it at home. So it works and it looks good. It looked really good in the show. I thought so anyway. Some people are shitting on it, but I actually thought it looked pretty badass. So looking forward to the Batgirl. And I keep calling it the Batgirl now, but it's not. It's just Batgirl. Batgirl, we may have a release window for Batgirl. That will be in December if the rumors are true. One of the producers was talking and they brought up Michael Keaton in the role and he said, yeah, you get to see Michael Keaton in November, obviously the Flash movie, and then you get to see him again in December. No official announcement on that yet, but that kind of seems to lead to the speculation that we will get Batgirl on HBO Max in December. And I will say it again, I still think they're missing the boat by not putting that thing in the theaters. Just my take. I really think that would be a hit in the theaters. We will move over to the Batman and the Batverse that Matt Reeves is building. But before I get into the film itself, Matt Reeves has been doing a lot of press, obviously, with the movie opening up this weekend. And we know there's two TV shows spinning out of the Batman. We've got a Gotham PD prequel, which is going to kind of lay the foundation for the Gotham Police Department that we see in the film. Don't know that it needs it, but I think it could be an interesting story to see. Especially Jeffrey Wright's Gordon is such... I was going to mention this more when I was talking about the film, but he's such a perfect moral compass. Like, he plays Jim Gordon perfectly, that it'd be good to see him in the cesspool of the Gotham Police Department. So that's one of the series that we got. Then we got the Penguin series, which will spin right out of the events of the Batman. And I won't say exactly that right now because that would lead to some spoilers. So just it's going to spin out of that. And then Reeves said there's a third series in development based around Arkham Asylum. We get a little bit of a glimpse at Arkham in the Batman. And it's definitely an Arkham that is established. And they make reference to the Arkham family in the Batman. So there's definitely stuff to mine there as well. And yeah, I don't know if this is too much coming out of one movie. But if Warner Brothers does want to build a sort of Reevesverse, Batverse, just whatever you want to call it, there's a lot to mine in Gotham, obviously. So yeah, that would be something very, very cool to look forward to. Now on to the Batman. And I'm telling you right now, I'm going to give you my review on this. If you want 100% spoiler free, head on over to the YouTube channel. There is it's like 8 minutes. My initial thoughts as soon as I left the movie theater in my car. That is 100% spoiler free. I am not going to guarantee that this is going to be 100% spoiler free because I'm going to get into a little bit of where characters are, some things they do. I don't want to give away the overall arcing story, but I may give away a few little things. So if you haven't seen the movie yet and you want to wait for this part, we're going to do our typical spoiler countdown. So time for you to bail out now. not Christian Bale out, but just Bale out now until you see the Batman and then come back and pick up from here. Or if you don't care and you just want to hear, let's go. So here we go. We're talking about the Batman in detail in 3, 2, 1. So as I said earlier in the podcast, the movie is amazing. It really is. It's, you know, my initial gut reaction to the film was that it's damn near perfect. Everything in this film fits. Nothing seems out of place, which is a nice change. Because most of the time, even with the best superhero films, there's usually one character's motivation that seems a little off, or a character does something to help move the story along that's like, well, I don't know if that character would do that. This movie doesn't have that. This is a well-thought-out film. Matt Reeves took his time with this movie. And it's hard to believe it's been, you know, kind of sitting around waiting because of the pandemic, because it feels like it was a movie that needed all this time to be as good as it is. I'm going to break it down character by character, go through some performances, and then we'll hit to some overarching other things. First, Robert Pattinson. Of course, the internet kind of went batshit when they announced that he was cast as the Batman. And, you know, Twilight, Batman, blah, 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 sparkly, Cape Crusader, whatever. All the stupid comments online, because those were dumb. If you don't watch movies and you just think of Robert Pattinson as the guy from Twilight, sure. But he's done a lot of work since then that made me confident that he would be good in the role. And I've learned my lesson. I really have. From calling out different casting choices that have come to bite me in the ass. Obviously the Heath Ledger one. When he was cast as a Joker, I was like, this is the worst casting. And obviously, you know, he proved everybody wrong. But I remember even as a kid, as a little kid, and the first Batman movie came out, the 1989 Michael Keaton Batman. And I remember seeing, I think it was an issue of Starlog magazine that had the news on the cover, right? Michael Keaton is Batman. And I was a fan of Michael Keaton's even as a kid. Like, I loved Mr. Mom and that. And I remember looking at it going, Batman? And as a kid, I was like, that's stupid. That guy's not Batman. And then he made me eat my words. And that was a guy I was a fan of. Like, I was a child, but I was a fan of Michael Keaton. And I still thought it was a terrible choice. And the guy's my favorite Batman. And that hasn't changed. And that's nothing against what Pattinson has done, what Affleck has done, what Bale has done. I have loved them all, to be honest. I even think Clooney could have been a good Batman if given a better script. But, so I've learned to not initially balk at casting decisions because I've had egg on my face more than once. And this time, anybody that, you know, kind of shit on his casting, they're going to be proven wrong. His performance is pitch perfect for this. It is a different Bruce Wayne than we have seen. It's not the billionaire playboy. It's kind of still a guy that's just not really... He has a mission, but it's not defined. You know, he hasn't found himself yet. He's still an angry child, really, at heart. And even though he's confident as Batman... There's still a sense, and he gets this across really well. I got this even in fight scenes and stuff like that. He's confident. He knows he can whoop your ass, but he's still unsure. He's still unsure, like, how far he goes. What are his limits? Who is he? He's still not 100% sure. He's still learning. He's learning on the job, basically. But we still see that he is an exceptionally intelligent Batman. At the heart of this film, it is a detective story. They told us that from the get-go, and they did not lie. It is a very, very film noir at times, and Pattinson's Batman fits this world perfectly. He does actual detective work in this movie, and not just kind of glazed over. We've seen that before in the Batman movies. They touch on it that, oh yeah, he is the world's greatest detective. Look, he figured out the Joker's poison recipe in the 89 Batman movie, but we don't see him doing the work. He just did it. And then Affleck did some detective work as well, like when he went to the pit fights and stuff like that. And Bale with the surveillance, everybody has touched on the fact that he's the world's greatest detective, because you have to. It's a central part of the character, but we've never seen detective work being done like as in depth as we see in this film. So again, pitch-perfect performance from Pattinson. Absolutely loved it. Can't wait to see him back under the cape and cowl. I mentioned Jim Gordon earlier, Jeffrey Wright's portrayal of not yet Commissioner Gordon, but he's good. He's really good. He's just solid. He reeks of a cop, and a good, honest police officer. And it acts as a great moral compass for this young, still learning Batman. You have this guy who's older and has been a part of some major things in Gotham. They mention a massive drug bust that is kind of an overarching thing that comes up quite a bit throughout the movie, and it ties into the central plot. And he was part of it, didn't realize that it wasn't what it seemed on the surface. Because he's just an honest guy, takes things for face value. So it's an interesting dichotomy in this film, as you have Batman, who kind of trusts no one and is still learning. And then on the opposite end of the scale, you have Gordon, who seems to trust everyone and is surprised when he can't trust everyone. So they're both learning different things, right? Batman is learning to trust and who to be. Gordon is learning, I've been way too trustful. And it's interesting to see them kind of work together. And their chemistry on screen is really good. They make a great pair on screen and play off each other very well. Okay, so let's get over to Selina Kyle before I get into the villains, because I wouldn't classify her as a villain. Zoe Kravitz as Catwoman. She's amazing. Amazing as Catwoman. It's almost like she, and I don't want to say that she did this like a stealing, but when I was watching her performance as Catwoman, there were slinky, sexy moments that made me think of the Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman. And then there was some sultry, just smooth moments. And I was like, oh, that's like the Eartha Kitt Catwoman. And it was all like the best parts of every Catwoman put into one. And her fighting was smooth. Oh my God. She's throwing kicks and stuff like that. Like, she gets hired onto the film and they put her into training, right? That's kind of what happens. And she took that training to heart. So committed. Amazing Catwoman. I really hope we see more of her. If somebody wants to give it a fourth spinoff out of this movie, Zoe Kravitz Catwoman show, I would be all over that. And I think it'd be nice to give Catwoman some solo time and a bit of a redemption from that solo movie. No offense to Halle Berry. But yeah, so perfect Catwoman. So now we'll switch on to the villains. Paul Dano as the Riddler was amazing. There is a scene, it's reminiscent of the Batman Joker interrogation room scene in The Dark Knight, where the Batman goes to talk to Paul Dano after he's been captured, and the back and forth between them and Paul Dano in that scene is so good. Like that scene, I don't know if they'll consider this movie. It comes out in March. Usually early year films have a harder time being remembered when it's Academy Award time. But Paul Dano, just that scene alone should be considered for like a best supporting actor role. Also, he's just damn right creepy. They took the Riddler in a different direction. If I had one major concern going into this film, it was this massively different variation on the Riddler. Because, you know, like the Riddler, even in the comics, even when he's been at his smartest, most maniacal in the comics, he's never been creepy, right? He's never been a guy that was trying to put any fear in you. And this Riddler does that. Very Zodiac inspired. We kind of got that from the look of the costume. And Paul Dano explained why he has the costume that he has. And it's like, damn it, that makes sense. So I watched an interview with him and they were talking about the look, and he said he came up with the idea of putting the kind of tape and that around his head because he was like, I couldn't shave my body. So it's to hide DNA. It's to basically make himself a ghost on the crime scene, something someone as smart as the Riddler would think of. I was like, damn it, that's good. And as I said, very Zodiac inspired. As a bit of a Zodiac nerd, I guess, there were definite scenes in the film where I was like, that's straight Zodiac. So the first time we hear from the Riddler he goes, "This is the Riddler speaking." Not a big deal, except one of the Zodiac letters starts with, "This is the Zodiac speaking." So it was a direct lift, which I love. And the Riddler used ciphers, which the Zodiac used, which is also a form of riddle. So it fits really well. It's smart. It's a take that works that nobody else saw. And I appreciate that. Like, no one else connected those dots except for Matt Reeves and Paul Dano and whoever else was working on the Riddler character on the film that I don't know, but they all deserve credit for giving us a fresh take that seems like it shouldn't work because it's so far from what we're used to with the character, but does work. It was a gamble that paid off big time. Colin Farrell's Penguin is very, very good, and I want more, and I would be pissed at the movie if I didn't know there was a show coming. If we didn't have that HBO Max show on its way for more of Colin Farrell's Penguin, I would be mad. But knowing that, I'm going to let it slide. Especially where he is in the film and where he is at the end. It actually gets me very excited for that show. So it worked, even at the kind of shittiness that we don't get enough of his Penguin in the film. One of the best villain turns is John Turturro as Carmine Falcone. He is the quintessential mob boss in this movie. And there are threads of the story that flow through him that without his delivery may not have come across the same way they do. Just absolutely fantastic. Now, I said I was going to be a little upset at the Penguin not being in there enough if I didn't know the show was coming. One character that doesn't have enough screen time, in my opinion, is Andy Serkis's Alfred. We don't get a lot of Alfred. Now, having said that, there are some good moments and some real touching growth moments between him and Bruce Wayne. And that sounded wrong when I said it. There was no growing because of touching. It was character growth and heartfelt touching moments in that between the two of them. I just wanted more of his Alfred. I really did just want more. So we'll see. But that'd be one criticism I had. Before I get into a couple of the other little things about the film, it is 3 hours. It doesn't feel like it. The couple of times it felt like it could have started to drag. It's almost like the movie realized it. The editing gets a big tip of the hat here. But it was like, oh shit, it is going to start to maybe drag if we keep going too long without this happening or cutting to this or doing this. And so it never lets itself drag. Really, really, really fucking smart. Now, they do some things. This would definitely be deemed spoilers. They're kind of out there now. They do some different things with the Wayne family, which I'm still not sure how I feel about it, but I can understand it. It's definitely a little bit of a different take. Basically, having Thomas Wayne not be the pristine pillar of society that he's always been portrayed as. And they make it more gray, which is kind of the world. And the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, you know, it's fantasy to think anyone is that perfect and that great and that benevolent 100% of the time. And it definitely turns things on its head there a little bit. And we'll see how that plays out kind of maybe going forward. It definitely opens the door for some things. There's some huge Easter eggs in this film for other characters. And I'll get to that in a second. The Batmobile intro in this movie, though, is probably the best introduction to a Batmobile on screen. And this Batmobile's a beast. It's loud. It's a beautiful sight to see. The whole Batmobile Penguin car chase sequence that we see a little bit of in one of the trailers. The sequence is much longer, thankfully, and worth every frame of film they used on it because it is just amazing. I loved it. That was one of my favorite moments of the film. Like, I was sitting there watching that, and as soon as the engine roars, and you don't even see the car, the engine roars, I was like, oh, shit. Like, I had this big, goofy, Joker-looking grin on my face. And, just amazing. Amazing, amazing. And when I talk about amazing, you could probably pick this out from the trailer, but the film is so beautifully shot. This is probably the most alive Gotham has felt in a film. Because even though, like, I love, obviously, Nolan's work, Gotham was a backdrop. And the people of Gotham took a bit of a center stage, in especially in The Dark Knight, but Gotham felt like a backdrop. In the Burton films, Gotham felt otherworldly, right? It didn't feel like a real city. It was this mythic, gothic city that nobody really lived in. And the same with the Schumacher films. And we didn't get to see much of Gotham really in any of the Snyder flicks. This one, Gotham feels very much like a living city. It's almost an extra character in the film. And I think that's a testament to how well they use the environments, how much Gotham is central to the story, and also just how beautifully it's shot. I mean, there's just beautiful, beautiful shots in this film that are amazing. And the score goes hand in hand with that. The musical score for this is pitch perfect as well. And I think that also helped bring the city of Gotham to life. As I say, it's an extra character in this movie. And it felt like a city that we could live in. It felt real. And some people are going to have a hard time with that because the movie is so grounded in reality. And at times it was like, fuck, that's a little bit with like kind of what the world is today. And maybe sometimes people don't want to think about that. They want the 100% escapism. But Gotham definitely felt like many cities I've visited. And so it felt so tangible. And maybe for really like the first time. Really great. And yeah, as I said, the score really helped with that. Now, one thing that I absolutely loved, and this is where I'm really going to get into some spoilers, the final sequence of the movie, people are inspired by the Riddler. So they kind of take up a bit of his cause and he's leading them to do something. I won't spoil everything here. But there's a final, obviously climactic battle. And at one point in the battle, Batman drops down from kind of the fight into water and goes to rescue people. And it's something that you don't see a lot of in Batman films, is him saving people. For as dark and as brooding as Batman is as a character, you know, he's the Dark Knight, he's also there to give the people of Gotham hope that their city can change and that things can be better. And we get this amazing moment of hope towards the end of this film, multiple ones actually, where, you know, he goes, there's wreckage in a building, he goes and he saves people. Very, very much like it was one of my favorite sequences in Batman versus Superman, was just the opening with Bruce Wayne saving people in the crowd. Because I was like, that's what he would fucking do. And it was the same here. He goes, he saves them, and then he's leading them out. And the shot is in one of the, like a fraction of a second of it, is in one of the trailers where he's leading people holding a flare. It is one of the most beautiful Batman scenes I have ever seen on film. And I was welling up with tears. I was like, that's Batman. That is the Batman that I think of when I think of when I read comics as a kid. That's Batman. Brilliant. So, so brilliant. And then there's another scene. He's helping a girl get airlifted out and she doesn't want to let go of his hand. And it was just like, because Batman makes you feel safe. And I was like, it was at like 20 seconds of film, if that. And it conveyed so much of a message. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And those events lead to a changing bat. And he acknowledges it a bit in a voiceover towards the end. That maybe his approach of being vengeance wasn't the right idea. Really good. Really, really good. The more, even as I'm thinking about it now, the film is so beautiful. I can't say enough how beautiful it is. I'm thinking of those shots in my head right now, and they are crystal clear. It's just, it's that kind of movie with those kinds of performances. As I said, there's definitely some Easter eggs throughout the film. At one point on the screen, Hush, not the character, but the word pops up. And that's definitely a big nod to the Hush character, who would fit perfectly in this world. Like, it'd be so great if that was the villain of the sequel. I'd be 100% for that. We also get a little Clown Prince of Crime action towards the end. Don't really see him, but we get to hear from him a little bit. I'll leave it at that. And those are kind of the big Easter eggs. There's a couple other little ones all throughout. And I cannot wait to see Matt Reeves dive back in. In some of the interviews, he said he's already thinking about the next movie, which is great. And I know Pattinson is on board. I don't know where they're going to go with it. There's plenty of places they could go. The comic book influences for this movie were very blatant. Like, you didn't have to go, I wonder what story they took inspiration from. It was pretty obvious some of the big stories that they used as inspiration for this story. Obviously, Long Halloween was a massive, massive influence on this film, as was No Man's Land towards the end. And Earth One, I think that portrayal of Batman and especially Alfred played a bit into this. And there was probably definitely some other ones as well. Some Batman and Catwoman team-ups. Dark Knight, Dark City, maybe a little bit. A lot of comic book references. So if they are going to go back to the comics, Pattinson's been vocal about wanting to have the Court of Owls pop up, which would, again, fit into this corrupt Gotham that Matt Reeves has built. Court of Owls would make perfect sense. Hush would make perfect sense. I don't even know necessarily, like I said, we got an Easter egg for Joker. I don't even know necessarily that Joker needs to pop up next film, to be totally honest. There's other avenues that I think they could explore, like Court of Owls or like Hush, that would feel more organic right out of this story. And then maybe we get Joker a little later on, or I'd love to see their take on like a Mr. Freeze would be really, really good. I'm thinking of different Batman villains, and obviously I'd love to see Bane again. Mad Hatter would be fun. Cause the way Reeves structured this film is there's the one main villain and then other villains are kind of there, kind of like the Long Halloween. And you could do that again in a sequel. Even the way what happens towards the end of the film, and again, I've given a couple spoilers, but I don't want to ruin the whole thing. There's a bit of an ecological disaster. Ivy might make sense to pop up. Poison Ivy. There's plenty of places for them to go, which is the great news. And the fact that everybody seems pretty committed to going somewhere for at least another round is amazing. But this is going to be hands down one of my top films of the year. I can say that already, even though I know there's still a shit ton of stuff to come. It's going to be hard to top this. And I really want to see this thing again. I do. 3 hours, I don't care. This could have been four at the way this was shot and the pacing and the story they were telling. If they ever wanted to release a director's cut that had like an extra 30 minutes or something in there, sign me up, because I want to see it all. Those were my thoughts on The Batman. Share yours with me, The Scotty Mars Show on Facebook and Instagram, at Scotty Mars on Twitter. And that will do it for this week's edition of the show. So until we chat again, have a great week.